This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The Middle East has been in crisis for more than half a century, a history punctuated with conventional wars and uprisings, and a long, convoluted, and often frustrating record of diplomacy. For more than 12 years, Dennis Ross served as America's chief Middle East negotiator, a period that covered the first President Bush and two Clinton administrations, from Prime Minister Shamir to Prime Minister Sharon, from a PLO in exile in Tunis to the Palestinian Authority, and from the first Gulf War to the eve of 9/11. In his new book, The Missing Piece, The Inside Story of the Fight for Middle East Peace, Dennis Ross chronicles all the twists and turns of the peace process, the personalities, the politics, the near misses, moderate successes, and ongoing efforts. We have the opportunity to ask one who was there about what happened, why, and about the appropriate role for the United States, the internal politics that afflict all sides, and where we go from here. Later, we'll talk about protesters, police, and preparations for the upcoming Republican National Convention in New York City. But first, Dennis Ross joins us in Studio 3A to talk about lost opportunities and the potential for peace agreement in the Middle East. Thanks very much for being with us today.
A real pleasure. Thank you.
If you'd like to join our conversation, the number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And Dennis Ross, you begin the book at the end of your story. It's an Oval Office meeting, PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat. It's the last few days of the Clinton administration. On the table is a final proposal asking serious compromises from both sides. Israeli Prime Minister, then Prime Minister Ehud Barak says yes, with some reservations. But at this meeting, Arafat asked for further negotiations. This is how P.J. Crowley, the National Security Council spokesman at the time, described what happened that day to the British Broadcasting Corporation.
We thought it was a very useful meeting, and the president, his answers were consistent with the parameters he set forth. We think they're the basis to move forward with further negotiations. The chairman had many questions. We'll have the opportunity to consult also with Prime Minister Barak today and perhaps others in the region, and then the president will make his best judgment on how to move forward in the time that he has remaining.
Well, you were at that meeting that day. Is that a fair description?
No, it's not a fair description. What it reflected was a recognition on our part that if we went and declared that Arafat had said no at that juncture, that that would have settled any possibility for Ehud Barak in the upcoming election in Israel, meaning sealed his fate. And we were not prepared to ensure that Barak would lose by declaring that there had been an effort now made and failed because Yasser Arafat was disagreeing or was saying no to it. So you didn't have us coming out publicly reflecting what had actually happened in the meeting.
And you put the blame. I mean, there's a, remarkably for a book by a diplomat and one who might hope at some point to be a diplomat again, you name names in this book, and one of the people who does not come out very well, particularly at that juncture, is Yasser Arafat.
I do, because I made a basic decision. The one thing I became persuaded of is that if you look at the Middle East, this is a region that is consumed by its myths. Everybody is very comfortable with the myths, and the myths bear very little relationship to reality. If we're going to make peace, you don't make it on the basis of reconciling myths. You make it on the basis of reconciling needs and adjusting to reality. And I felt it was essential, having had the perspective that I had, to tell the story of what happened on the one hand and then to draw the lessons from it on the other.
You put the blame on Arafat, unable at the last gasp to take an agreement that, well, certainly in retrospect, looks like it might be the best deal he has ever offered. Whether it's the final agreement or not,
right,
we shall have to see.
Right.
Others, though, have pointed out that Yasser Arafat at that time was being asked to make serious compromises to a president who was on his way out of office and to an Israeli prime minister who was, even if he got an agreement, still likely to be on his way out of office. Why sit on what might have been a sinking life raft with two politicians who were about to go out of office?
Well, for several reasons. Number one, had he done it, then he would have established, in fact, what was an agreement that would have affected everybody else. He would have likely had international support for the agreement. It might well have affected the Israelis. I think it would have. But the fact is it would have affected everybody in the future. Saying yes could only have been in Palestinian interest. Saying no was bound to sink them in a deteriorating spiral. And in fact, and I say it in the book, I mean, right before that meeting, one of my good friends on the Palestinian side, Abu Allah, who happens to be the current prime minister, was sent to see me by Arafat And I take him aside, and I say to him, look, I have to tell you the truth. I don't want you coming back in 3 months blaming me for not telling you what's going to happen. If the chairman says no when he comes to see the president, you not only lose this administration, I won't be there. You know, what a lot of your friends like to complain about me, but they're the ones who call me at 3 in the morning. The President Clinton, he's going to be gone. You're going to have a new American administration that's going to come in. Having seen what we've done, they're going to want nothing to do with Arafat. You're going to have, in all likelihood, then a new administration in Israel, and your 97% of the West Bank will become 40 to 45%. And your capital in Arab East Jerusalem will be gone. And even the right of return for refugees to their own state, to your state, is going to be gone. The Israelis out of the Jordan Valley, that's going to be gone. This is what you're going to face. So there was a lot to be lost by saying no, very little to be gained by saying no. And indeed, I think it set in motion what we've seen on the Palestinian side, that if you look at the situation, they have lost a lot. And one of the points I like to make, if you look, and I show this in the book, if you look at what the Palestinians say they were offered, what Yasser Arafat says he was offered, and compare it to what he was actually offered, the only conclusion you can draw is that he lies about it. If what we offered was so bad, why lie about it?
You had an earlier meeting with Yasser Arafat where similar language was openly used, and I gather pineapple juice was spilled.
It was grapefruit juice, but it was
correction.
It had more to do with this was when I was negotiating the Hebron agreement with him, and the night before this meeting, I had seen him in Bethlehem, and he rarely is very clear in terms of what he wants. As a negotiator, his style is basically to say as little as possible and always force the negotiator to come towards him.
Good technique.
It's an excellent technique. You say as little as possible, and you wait for the other side to always respond. Well, on this previous night, I said to him, look, I can't stay out here and negotiate forever. I need to know what it is you want. And he was very clear and ticked off 6 items that he wanted. So I went and spent the rest of the night with then Prime Minister Netanyahu, and finished at about 6 in the morning with him, and then went back to see Arafat the next night because he was busy doing a number of ceremonial things during the day. And when I started to go over what he'd asked me to get, and I started with the least important first, because knowing Arafat, I wasn't sure that what he said the night before would be where he would be on this evening. So I started with the least important items, and he dismissed it immediately. So I tried one more, and he dismissed it immediately. And I said, what's the point of me going to get what you want when you now say that you don't want it anymore? And he said, that's not what I asked for. And I said, it's exactly what you asked for. And we got into this thing where he, in a sing-song way, said to me, you are always right, I am always wrong. And I said, look, this time I am absolutely right because this is exactly what you asked for. So he said, are you calling me a liar? And I said, if the shoe fits. And I got up, stalked out, and opened the double doors to his office in Gaza, flung my notebook, and inadvertently hit a pitcher of grapefruit juice. And it certainly made a point.
From the outsider's point of view, the vantage, it often seems like sometimes kids shouting on a schoolyard. It's a little discouraging to come away and actually hear that's from time to time the case.
You know, this is a conflict that has deep roots. It's really two nations, two national movements competing for the same space. But there is embedded in this conflict a desire to constantly prove that you're right and the other side is wrong as a way of trying to create leverage for yourself in the negotiations.
And vindicating the past.
Absolutely. There is an enormous amount of effort to vindicate the past. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote a chapter in this book on narratives is because the last year of the negotiations, when we were actually dealing with the existential questions, like Jerusalem, like borders, like refugees, that go to the heart of self-definition and identity, I would hear one side and then the other say, well, that's not my narrative. And the other say, no, that's not my narrative. And so I decided, well, I would write what their narratives were, because the narrative is their story, how they describe their story and their circumstances. And what you see is really what the point of departure is for negotiations. There is embedded again in the conflict a almost an overpowering zero-sum quality to it, that their gain must be my loss. Mm-hmm. And part of that is the history, and part of that is fear for the future. And what I wanted to do was to try to get at it from both sides' perspectives and then be able to say, all right, how do we create not a zero-sum reality, but a reality where both sides gain?
Our guest is Dennis Ross, for more than 12 years the chief U.S. envoy to the Middle East. He's written a new book chronicling that period. It's called The Missing Piece, the inside story of the fight for Middle East peace. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Jim, who's calling from Webster Grove, Missouri.
Yeah, Dennis, I was really curious what the missing piece for me is how did you ever end up in such a difficult job? How did you stay there so long? You seem like you've been there forever, and I just am amazed that anybody could do that.
Opening in the New York Times, envoy, Middle East.
Right. Yeah. just lucky, I guess. I think, you know, if it is interesting that I had other positions in the government, but I always had a Middle East responsibility. In the first Bush administration, I was also responsible for being a negotiator on arms control issues, START and conventional weapons in Europe. And the same with the unification of Germany and NATO, especially working with the Soviets in terms of how to manage that. But this was a conflict for me that I'd always had an interest in on the one hand, and it was a conflict that, in my eyes, really had a human face. Everything else I did was a kind of abstraction. Here I saw what was, in fact, the real consequence of not having agreements. And given the kind of passion I brought to the subject, I became someone increasingly responsible for it and was completely committed to it. It became a real mission for me.
Let me ask, did your background as an American Jew, was that an obstacle towards getting this kind of a job? And was it an obstacle once you were in the job?
It's a very interesting question, because when I first went into the government, if you were Jewish and working on the Middle East, it was seen as a contradiction. And that began to change during the Reagan administration when Secretary Shultz was the Secretary of State. He made a very conscious decision to make sure that those in the State Department who served in the Arab world would also serve in Israel. Prior to his time, that was not the rule. In fact, if it happened at all, it was quite the exception. And so you began to see a change then. I, from a fairly early time, once I was in an administration, I was first in the Carter administration, was working on Middle East issues as well as other issues. And it didn't become a problem for me, certainly with in the first Bush administration with Secretary Baker. He wanted me to work on this issue. He saw me as having an expertise on the issue as well as on other issues. In the Arab world, it was an issue in a public sense, but not in a private sense. I never had a problem with anybody that I dealt with at the negotiating level or the leaders. Now, partly because they saw me representing the United States of America, partly because they came to know me in terms of good times and bad, and I was a known quantity, and my commitment to this issue became pretty clear quickly, I think. And I think also, even if they got along with me at a certain level, they saw a certain value in being able to complain about me. You can always complain about the negotiator. The negotiator is fair game. But also the fact that I was Jewish gave them an easy explanation. If I was being unfair, well, you know why it's unfair. So there was an undercurrent of that throughout the process, but it was never a factor in negotiations.
I wonder, by the way, Jim, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it. Did it come to you from the other side, though? Did Israelis say, you're a Jew, how could you?
There was certainly some of that, yes, in the during Yitzhak Shamir's time as prime minister in the first Bush administration. There was a certain undercurrent of that from time to time as well. Mm. And in a sense, both positions reflected the same assumption. Well, because you're Jewish, you must adopt a certain kind of position. And as I used to say, well, because you're Jewish means you don't believe in peace.
Dennis Ross was for 12 years America's leading envoy to the Middle East, chief negotiator in an arrangement to try to arrive at a Arab-Israeli peace. He's documented that book, those efforts, in a new book called The Missing Piece. When we come back from a short break, more of your calls and emails, totn@npr.org, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the Middle East peace process with the man behind many of the scenes, former Middle East envoy Dennis Ross. His new book chronicling his role in the negotiations came out last week. If you have questions about what happened, why, and where we go from here, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, totn@npr.org. And let's go to Brad, who's on the line from Salt Lake City.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, Brad. Go ahead.
I have two questions. The first one, just briefly, I want to know, in the opinion of the guest, was the failure on the part of Chairman Arafat to accept the proposal that was given, was it just incompetence, or was it something more sinister than that? And the second question that I have is, if, you know, due to some unforeseen miracle, we were somehow actually able to get, say, Prime Minister Sharon and Chairman Arafat into the same room again with the U.S. president, offer them a similar, if not, you know, the same arrangement that was offered before, and if both men were to sign off on it and shake hands and walk away friendly, they go back home, are either of them in a position to even make good on their end of the bargain to actually enforce the terms of the agreement, or would it be irrelevant at that point? And if not, what does that say about the possibilities of there ever being any kind of peace?
Okay, Brad, two good questions. Why don't we begin with the first one?
I think it was not a case of incompetence. It was in Arafat's case, in part. I think the Arafat cannot really give up the conflict. The conflict has come to define him. The cause defines him. The concept of struggle defines him. His grievances and claims define him. Arafat is someone who can reach limited understandings, limited agreements. We, after all, did five with him, several of which I negotiated almost entirely with him. But in each of those cases, he never had to make a commitment that was irrevocable. To understand Arafat is to understand that he will never close a door, he will never foreclose an option, and for him, ultimately, he will judge himself in his own eyes as to how he'll be weighed in history. He has an elevated sense of himself. He sees himself as one of the great leaders in Middle Eastern Islamic history. He will live with Israel beyond the time that he might be alive, but he doesn't want to be the one recorded in history as the one who gave up a true one-state solution. So for him, this was much more fundamental, and I didn't realize it throughout the whole process. I asked myself in the book at the beginning, how could I, of all people who spent so much time with him, how could I not have seen that this was where he was coming from?
What do you mean by true one-state solution?
Meaning that it's a Palestinian state. Basically, what he wants is a Palestinian state that will be from the Mediterranean Sea to the Iraqi border, because that was the original Palestine mandate. So that's the way he sees himself. It isn't that he would, as I said, he might well accept an Israel beyond the time that he's alive. He might accept it for 20, 25, 30 years, maybe 50 years. But what he doesn't want is in history to be seen as the one who gave up the idea that eventually there'll be only a Palestinian state with a Palestinian majority.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that?
Brad, you got a big one, but go ahead, if you keep it short.
Is that motivated by, as some people would try to say, by just anti-Semitism, by just wanting to throw the Jews into the ocean, or is it?
No, I actually don't think so. I don't think so. I think it's not. I mean, he prides himself on. I can't tell you how many times I heard that the Jews are our cousins. He prides himself on his relationship with Jews as Jews, and this is not something that I think he's prepared to openly acknowledge, but I think the fact is it's governed much more by a sense of what the legitimate Palestinian destiny ought to be. And as the great Palestinian leader, which is the way he perceives himself, he doesn't want to be seen as the one who gave up on that destiny. I'm not one of those who, by the way, who believes that Arafat is someone who believes in stages, a staged approach. You know, First, you take part of you get part of the land, and then you're going to get more of it, and then you get rid of Israel step by step. It may sound like an artificial distinction, but I think had he wanted to do it in the staged approach, he should have accepted the Clinton ideas, because then he would have had almost everything anyway, and it would have been a much stronger base. But the reason he couldn't is because we had embedded in this that he had to publicly come out and accept that this was the end of the conflict, and there were no more claims. Now, once he had to publicly embrace the idea of end of conflict and no more claims, then he was no longer in a position, basically, to keep the conflict alive. And Arafat is not going to end the conflict.
Brad, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's talk now with Ned. Ned's calling from Framingham, Massachusetts.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air, Ned.
Yes. There are three or four points I wanted to make quickly.
Well,
one is that...
Why don't we try to hold our listeners to two? We gave Brad, the previous caller, two.
Two. That Yasser Arafat made the great concession at Oslo, where he gave up 78% of the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean, that is Palestine, Israel. Barak pocketed that and then went to Camp David with Clinton and Dennis Ross's support and asked for more, and in fact wanted to cut up the West Bank with settlements and military bases and so forth, so there would have been no viable Palestinian state. Barak offered tokenism for the Palestinians in East Jerusalem and denied the right of return, which is guaranteed in international law, to the Palestinian refugees. So Arafat's position at Camp David was much closer to international law and human rights treaties that Israel has signed than was that of Barak, who tried to, with Clinton's support, impose a might-makes-right settlement on the Palestinians. The second point is that Dennis Ross has worked with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which is part of the Israeli lobby, both before and now currently. I think he's director his service with the U.S. government.
A distinguished fellow, I think.
He's not a disinterested party in this case, and I think his book has received several very critical reviews, the current one in The Nation. And finally, Clinton and Ross allowed Israel to put in more settlements after Oslo between 93 and 2000, therefore undercutting the credibility of the Israeli position and the U.S. position, so that Arafat didn't have the support of his own people. If he had made a settlement based on Barak and Clinton's proposal, he would have been repudiated by 95% of the Palestinians.
Well, let's get a response from Dennis Ross.
Look, it's. I would really urge you to read the book, because if you did, maybe you would. Some of the facts you claim as facts are not facts. And, for example, you say that, in fact, everything was going to be cut up, the territory was going to be cut up, settlements and bases. That's simply not true. And, in fact, as I said, if what we offered was so bad, why mislead people about it? If you couldn't accept a compromise, if you couldn't accept conceding on about 3% of the territory, explain that that was the case. I'm the one who wrote the ideas. I know what we presented.
No.
Yes, I know what we presented. You don't know. Obviously, you don't. But let me.
No commitment. The Boston Globe reported that Barak made no commitment at Camp David to even dismantle one settlement. And in your book, settlement is not even in the index.
Well, why don't you read the book?
Yossi Beilin's book, and his book is co-reviewed in the current Nation. A colleague whom you, an Israeli negotiator. He differs with you in several important points.
Not on the facts.
Yes,
not on the facts.
Facts.
Well, look.
On the facts.
I don't think we're going to reach agreement.
Let me make two general points. The first one, one of the reasons I wrote the book is because there's a lot of revisionism out there, and I actually present the maps so you can compare the maps of what the Palestinians say they were offered with what it is they were actually offered. So that's number one. But number two. Your general point, the most important point you made, was that the Palestinians made their concession before they came to Oslo. The beginning of Oslo was their concession. I can assure you that nobody on the American side or the Israeli side thought that the Oslo process was completed at the very beginning. The Oslo process talked about an interim period to resolve the interim issues and then a period to resolve the permanent status questions of Jerusalem and borders and refugees. And the whole issue of relationship with neighboring states, which was the issue of sovereignty and the powers of sovereignty, all that was to be negotiated. So to say that the concession was made in 1993, what was the point of the Oslo process then? The Oslo process was to be a period where there was a mutual adjustment on both sides. And the fact of the matter is, if there's a right of return for Palestinian refugees to Israel, it means, and Yossi Beilin says this as well, it means that you are in favor of a one-state solution, not a two-state solution. A right of return for Palestinian refugees to their state, completely right. They should have that right. But if there's going to be a two-state solution, a Jewish state and an Arab state, which was the original partition plan, then the only way you can have that is if there is not an absolute right of return for Palestinian refugees.
Let me ask you about one track of negotiations which doesn't get quite so much attention in this country, and that was the negotiations with Syria that came within a few meters of realization. No one thought that this was actually in the cards, but you were very, very close to an agreement with Syria.
We were, in fact, very close to an agreement with Syria. We basically had understandings on the security arrangements, on how to manage the water issue, on how normalization was going to be implemented, and also pretty much on the border. The main gap that remained on the border was about 400 meters off of the Sea of Galilee. And I think what happened here was less a difference on substance and more a difference on psychology and politics in terms of when one leader was ready, the other wasn't. Certainly when Yitzhak Rabin offered us what I refer to as the pocket, he gave us a conditioned commitment to withdraw from the Golan Heights in August of 1993, reaffirmed it with a definition related to June 4, 67 in July of 1994, because Assad was saying no negotiations unless he knew that's what the border was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Rabin at that time felt that his needs, when he says you get this provided all of our needs are met, that would allow him to define the border, because you can't find that border anywhere on a map. Now, when Barak became the prime minister, we then got back into a negotiation, and we ended up going to a place called Shepherdstown, where we had a summit. At that juncture, you had Assad ready to do a deal, because on all the issues, the Syrians were prepared to move. Barak saw that his political base on this issue was more difficult than he had anticipated, and he wasn't ready at that moment. When he was ready later on, Assad had lost interest and was focused on succession and trying to pave the way for his son. So unlike the Israeli-Palestinian issue, where I believe it was a case where Palestinian negotiators were ready to do the deal, but Yasser Arafat wasn't, so there was an asymmetry in terms of a leader not being prepared. On the Syrian-Israeli deal, it was less the asymmetry between leaders who had the capability and will to do a decision and more being out of sync in terms of when they were ready to do it.
This book is replete with references to we left wherever it was optimistic, but our hopes were premature, or it turned out that every advance brought several new and important questions we hadn't considered beforehand. It's, among other things, it's a history of process and what happens from a journalist point of view. It's interesting to note that I think at a couple of points you go in and agree to issue a non-statement statement. We thought they were non-statement statements. It was nice to know that we were right. But the when you get down to the points where this near deal with Syria scuppered at various moments by internal opposition within one of the players. This is a factor that often goes overlooked, that if all of the planets are in alignment, that particular planet has to be in alignment too.
One of the things we have to remember is that every negotiation involves not just the issues that have to be resolved, but the political circumstances in which you're trying to resolve the conflict. You're dealing with what is a historic conflict. You're dealing with what are deeply felt emotions, with a sense, as we talked earlier, about, well, we're really right in terms of our position and our claims, and they're really wrong. And that plays on the political overtones, the political overlay that is always a part of this. On the Israeli side, you have a very dynamic democracy. And even if you don't have the equivalent of that throughout the Arab world, what you do have is a sense of what should be acceptable in any agreement. And I used to say about Assad, it wasn't that Assad was measuring what he had to do against a specific domestic public opinion, but in his own mind, he was trying to meet the standards of what the Arab nationalist opinion would view as being a dignified deal. So even though the circumstances in which they look at their politics might be different, they have their own particular needs and standards that are always going to be applying.
We're talking with Dennis Ross. His new book is The Missing Piece, The Inside Story of the Fight for Middle East Peace. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's take a call from Dave in Durham, North Carolina.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Ross, I had a question. Why does the U.S. continue to pretend to encourage negotiations between the Palestinians and Israel when Israel has proven it has no intentions at all to withdraw its settlements from the West Bank? And why does the U.S. foreign policy not issue an ultimatum to Israel to simply get out, or they will risk losing our financial aid and support? It seems like a real simple equation to me.
Well, the interesting thing is we now have an Israeli government, which most people would never have believed would have done it, that's made the decision to pull all the settlements out of Gaza and four settlements out of the West Bank. They're doing it in a context in which they've faced violence from the other side. So I think you have to look at not only the circumstances, but also the fact that you have the Israelis doing something that's unprecedented, even on the settlement issue. And this is coming from the very architect of the settler movement, the guy who built the settlements.
But everybody knows that the Gaza settlements are not really important in this whole final negotiation, and that the ones that are being offered on the West Bank are really not very significant either. These are very minor issues.
Well, they're not so minor issues when the fact is nobody predicted that Ariel Sharon, of all people, would be the one to get out of Gaza. When the Palestinian prime minister says he's the last person I would have predicted to do this.
But he hasn't done it yet, and I doubt he will. It's the whole story.
Well, I think he actually will do it, and the fact is he's turned his majority government into a minority government over this issue. He's created great turmoil on the Israeli side politically because of it. That would seem to indicate that he's pretty serious about doing it. But The fact is, there'll be a process and he'll do it. When he does it, it creates an opening. And that's one of the reasons you see so much turmoil on the Palestinian side today. Palestinians know that when the Israelis are out of Gaza, then they have to govern themselves. They have to be responsible for themselves. You can't blame it on the Israelis. You have to get your act together. And that's one of the reasons you're seeing unprecedented challenges against Yasser Arafat today.
Let me ask, there's an undercurrent to this book which talks about regional issues at various points. You say the Israelis knew that they had to reorder the Middle East or fix the Middle East because they were running out of time. Eventually, at one point you say Iraq, well, that's no longer in the cards, but Iran would acquire weapons of mass destruction. Specifically, I think you're talking about nuclear weapons.
Right.
With Iraq, I guess that's out of the picture now, but in terms of Iran, it certainly is not. Is there a feeling that time is on nobody's side here?
I think there are sort of two aspects to this. Time is a factor. In the case of Yitzhak Rabin, he made the decision. Not only was he of the generation that fought to found the state, but his view was he had an obligation to pass on a different kind of state to the next generation of Israelis. He looked also at what he thought was a circumstance in which Israel had a very favorable strategic set of positions. But he looked 10 years down the road and said, look, it won't stay that way unless we can make peace with our neighbors. So that's why he felt an imperative to make peace. If you look at Ariel Sharon today, he isn't talking about making peace because he says there's no partner. But what he's being driven by are the demographics, another aspect of time. One aspect of time are potential threats militarily, weapons of mass destruction, but another is the time bomb of demographics. If Israel were to stay where it is today in the territories, in Gaza and the West Bank, by the year 2010, there will be more Arabs than Jews between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River, which means the Israelis would be a minority governing a majority. It's not sustainable. Not sustainable from Israel's standpoint of how it sees itself, not sustainable from its position internationally. And you see someone like Ehud Olmert, who is the deputy prime minister, someone who was one of the princes of Likud, who is saying what we're doing as Gaza is fine, but we got to get out of 80 to 85% of the West Bank, even if we do it unilaterally. Again, time being driven by the demographic issue.
The past 12 years of Middle East diplomacy is chronicled in Dennis Ross's book, The Missing Peace, The Inside Story of the Fight for Middle East Peace. Dennis Ross, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
Dennis Ross was here with us in Studio 3A. When we come back from a break, we're still 2 weeks away from the Republican National Convention in New York City. Already, both the protesters and the police are gearing up. Now the FBI is getting into the act. We'll get an update on tactics and tensions after the break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.